This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Of U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza. Now, European Human Rights Monitor says 4% of the Gaza population has been killed, injured, or missing. Now, to avenge the assassination of a Hamas official in Beirut, Lebanon's Hezbollah fires more than 60 rockets on Israel's main military base. And Iraq's Islamic Resistance scales up attacks on U.S. military facilities in Iraq and Syria, including Al-Tanf base in southern Syria. Now, Israeli airstrikes and shelling continue to hammer Gaza, leaving more fatalities throughout the besieged strip. The regime's fresh attacks have killed two people and injured a number of others in the central city of Deir al-Balah. Israeli warplanes also rained down bombs on a residential building in the southern city of Khan Yunis. As a result, 18 dead bodies were brought to the European hospital. Israeli genocidal war on Gaza is now in its 92nd day. Total death toll now stands at over 22,600. Most of them women and children. And according to a European NGO, more than 90,000 people are now dead, wounded, or missing in the Palestinian territory, and that makes up around 4% of the total Gaza population. Euromed Human Rights Monitor also says Israel's recurring attacks have led to the destruction of almost 70% of Gaza's civilian facilities and infrastructure. The United Nations has warned the aid mission in Gaza is almost impossible to complete amid Israel's relentless bombardments of the blockaded territory.
Martin Griffiths, the Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs. He says that 3 months since the horrific attacks of October 7th, Gaza has become a place of death and despair. He said the humanitarian community has been left with the impossible mission of supporting more than 2 million people, even as its own staff are being killed and displaced, as communication blackouts continue, as roads are damaged and convoys shot at, and as commercial supplies vital to the survival of people there are almost non-existent.
Tremblay added that what is now significant in Gaza is having a humanitarian ceasefire, finding a way to address the growing needs of the Gaza population and facilitating aid delivery. The remarks by the UN official come as hospitals and other critical facilities in Gaza remain the prime targets of Israeli airstrikes and artillery fire. Doctors in Gaza say lack of equipment and staff is hindering efforts to treat those who've been injured in Israeli attacks.
The difficulties we are facing are the huge number of injuries we are receiving compared to the lack of equipment and medical staff. We're working 24 hours a day in order to be able to treat all the injured we're receiving. We're only one team here at the Lembre Construction Unit with no replacement, and we're working heavily to be able to treat the huge number of injuries we are receiving.
According to UN figures, hospitals and other vital medical infrastructure in Gaza and the occupied West Bank have been attacked nearly 600 times since October the 7th. The World Health Organization says ongoing reduction of humanitarian space plus continuing attacks on health care are pushing people in Gaza to a breaking point. It says children in the besieged territory are more vulnerable as cases of diseases. As cases of disease are on the rise and nutritional levels are plummeting. Israeli forces have carried out fresh raids on several areas of the occupied West Bank. During the raids, a number of Palestinians are either injured or arrested, and earlier, Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Candil, joined us with some details.
We can say that every day Israeli forces raid several areas across the occupied West Bank. This time, the Israeli forces had raided the village West Nablus, and the clashes had been taking place between Palestinian fighters and the Israeli forces, according to the residents of the village of Yitma. A number of Palestinians had been wounded, and others had been arrested. The exact number of those who were arrested are still unknown. The Israeli forces had also raided the center of the city of Nablus, the old town of the city of Nablus, and the vehicles had been seen raiding the center of the city of Nablus. Palestinians there said they heard exchange of fire between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces as well. The Israeli troops had raided the village of Qatani, also near Ramallah, and at least one Palestinian had been wounded. In Tulkarem, raids have at least in a number of villages around the city of Tulkarem, and the main aim, according to the Israeli forces, is to arrest Palestinians.
Now, Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says it's targeted an Israeli military base with rockets in reprisal for regime's assassination of a top Hamas official in Beirut. Hezbollah said it fired 62 rockets toward the Meron air control base located in the northern part of occupied Palestine. The resistance movement added that the strike was part of initial response to the killing of Saleh al-Ruri, who was assassinated in an Israeli drone strike on Tuesday. Following Hezbollah's missile launches, warning sirens sounded in over 90 Israeli settlements in Galilee and Golan. That's according to Israeli media reports. And since October the 7th, Hezbollah and Israeli military have been exchanging fire, targeting areas bordering southern Lebanon. And now joining us out of Beirut is Ali Rizka, political commentator. 62 rockets is quite a significant response. Your initial thoughts on this?
Well, this was the kind of response we were expecting. If you listen to the speeches of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the retaliation was bound to come, and was bound to come soon. That was what we could read between the lines in his latest remarks during those two speeches which he gave this week. Basically, Hezbollah's response, there was retaliation. It was quite a strong retaliation, but not reaching the degree or level which would drag Israel into war, or which would ignite an all-out war. And this remains Hezbollah's strategy, at least up until now, not allowing Israel to change the rules of the game or the rules of engagement without, as I said, taking any action that would create a grave danger of imminent war. This particular operation was targeted, the target was military, by the way. It was not civilian, which is important to note. It appears that there was no change in the caliber or the quality of weapons which were used during the attack. The statement by Hezbollah referred to various weapons without, indicating a change in the quality or using more advanced weapons. So, as I said, this is the kind of retaliation which we were expecting, a quick, firm retaliation, but at the same time, a calculated one.
And to your point, Mr. Rizk, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said exactly that. Usually we might say that at a particular time and place, we're going to give a response. We're not going to say that this time. We're going to leave it up to the military to actually make it immediate and swift. And to your point, it came within a day of him making that very speech.
Indeed, and this just goes to show that the Israeli front remains very vulnerable to Hezbollah operations. No doubt Israel was anticipating a response, but despite this anticipation, all the precautionary measures it might have taken failed to prevent an attack. And again, this shows how how Israel remains vulnerable and how Hezbollah, always or very often succeeds in penetrating the Israeli front or being able to successfully carry out the attacks. And I think this, increasingly diminishes the awe or that invincible reputation which the Israeli army used to enjoy. Of course, we have to wait. As the statement said, this is a preliminary or an initial response, so more to come. And I expect, however, that the, other responses which would come about, I would presume that there would be at least one additional response, but these additional responses will also be calculated and will be designed not to ignite another war.
Okay, thank you, Ali Rizk. You actually answered my next question, which we're going to see. The statement implies there's going to be more than this initial response, and you just answered that. Stay safe. Thank you for joining us here or shed some light on the 62 rockets fired by Hezbollah at occupied Palestine in response for the assassination in Beirut at Tuesday night of Hamas deputy head Sheikh Saleh al-Ruri's assassination. Meanwhile, reports coming out of Iraq say that resistance forces have carried out yet another operation against U.S. forces in Syria. Iraq's Islamic Resistance said it carried out a drone strike targeting America's Al-Tanf and al-Shaddadi bases. Now, there are no reports of damage or casualties yet. Resistance groups have, though, carried out a number of attacks against U.S. interests in Iraq and Syria bases, to be exact, over the past weeks in response to Washington's support for Israeli genocide in Gaza. On Wednesday, U.S. forces in Iraq also hit the headquarters of Iraq's popular mobilization units, killing a senior commander with a resistance movement in Baghdad. Anti-U.S. sentiment is high in Iraq, and now Baghdad says that the government is seeking to permanently end U.S. presence in the country. Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani said government plans to set up a committee, in fact, to arrange the ouster of U.S. forces. Two Israeli-owned oil tankers have reportedly been targeted by unidentified drones off of the Maldives, an archipelago state and country in the Indian Ocean. An informed official has been cited by the media as saying that both tankers were seriously damaged by the explosions. Vessels are supposed to sail through the Bab el-Mandab Strait and the Red Sea before reaching their destination. Tankers are forced to change course to avoid more attacks, and no group has yet claimed responsibility for their drone strikes. The Israeli regime has also not commented. Israeli and Israeli-linked commercial ships have been the targets of attacks in the Red Sea by Yemen's armed forces over U.S.-managed Israeli genocidal war on Gaza. They've already made it clear all vessels except Israel-bound can safely sail through the strategic waterway. Yemenis say their stance will not change until Israel ends its deadly onslaught on Palestinians in Gaza. Leader of Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says no Israeli military post in the north of occupied territories has been spared from the group's strikes.
The Islamic Resistance carried out more than 670 operations during a period of 3 months. 670. In some days, the number of operations reached 23. The average is between 6 to 7 military operations daily. The border posts which were targeted, 48 border posts, meaning that not one border post from Nakoura to the end of the Shabah farms, not one was spared. All of them were targeted more than once. This is the number of posts, but the number of targeting, 494.
Nasrallah said group has forced Israeli soldiers to evacuate many posts near Lebanon, and the rest are, in his words, hiding like rats. He also said regime censoring a number of its casualties to avoid boosting the morale of resistance fighters. Nasrallah also reiterated the assassination of a senior leader of the Hamas resistance movement in Beirut will not go unpunished. Now, an advanced destroyer has been added to the naval fleet of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, the IRGC, during a ceremony in the country's southern port city of Bandar Abbas. New domestically designed and manufactured vessel named Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis can sail for 14 days and 2,000 nautical miles with the ability to evade enemy radars. Dozens of high-speed boats equipped with missile launchers were also inducted into the IRGC naval fleet. A group of top military commanders, including IRGC's commander-in-chief, Major General Hossein Salami, and commander of the IRGC Navy, Rear Admiral Ali Reza Tangsiri, were present at this ceremony. Now, Iran's intelligence ministry says it's identified and apprehended several people involved in the Kerman terrorist attacks. In a statement, the ministry said it identified one of the suicide bombers as a Tajik national. Also, 11 members of the terrorist logistics team were arrested across six provinces of the country. Some of the terrorist pieces of equipment discovered at their residence include suicide vests, remote control devices, and detonators. Ministry says it will continue operations until the very last person involved is arrested. The deadly terror attacks rocked the city of Kerman on Wednesday as thousands were attending the assassination anniversary of top anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani. On the 4th martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, Iran's Sacred Defense Museum has opened a new exhibition to the public. Dubbed the Resistance Hall, the exhibition allows a glimpse into the top commander's personal life and his illustrious military career. Gisu Misha Ahmadi takes us there.
Celebrating the life and legacy of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, honoring the sacrifices he made and inspiring future generations. The Resistance Hall of Tehran's Sacred Defense Museum is dedicated to the top commander.
The significance of Qasem Soleimani was spreading the message of the Islamic Revolution throughout the world. And due to his activities and actions and efforts, the decline of the United States internationally speeded up. And it was the result of his work that the United States policies in this part of the world failed and continue to fail.
The exhibition takes visitors back in time to the era of the Iran-Iraq War and other regional conflicts in which the top commander played a decisive role.
The exhibition has 12 sections, each of which pertains to a specific era of General Soleimani's life, from the imposed war to conflicts in Bosnia and Herzegovina, Lebanon, Yemen, Palestine, and most importantly, the fight against Daesh terrorists. Visitors can easily acquaint themselves with Haj Qasem and his way of life and his legacy as they walk down the hall and visit different sections.
Following a chronological timeline, the exhibition is incredibly comprehensive in its coverage of the role Haj Qasem played as a top military commander and strategist, and for many visitors, probably the most interesting part they might know little about is Bosnia and Herzegovina.
You know, if we did not have Iran on our side, if Iran did not help, then I'm doubting if Bosnia and Herzegovina would exist nowadays. Iranian help was detrimental in this, the hardest period of Bosnian life. And Soleimani had important role in all of that. So when we remember him, remember really contribution of great nation of Iran.
An all-too-familiar description of the top commander, as many nations believe him to have done the same for them as well, including Palestinians. Fighting Daesh terrorists and eventually defeating them is probably what Haj Qasem is best known for. With the final section of the exhibition showcasing remains of that war, along with a wax statue of the hero himself right next to the vehicles he used to ride back then. A hero in the fight against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani is a symbol of courage to whom people in the region owe their freedom and security. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Thank you for tuning in and bye-bye for now.
a diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Muhammad al-Salak suffered enormously because of the Zionist regime's wars against Gaza. In the current war, he has been killed at the age of 48. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Muhammad al-Salak has suffered enormously because of the Zionist regime's war against Gaza. In the current war, he has been killed at the age of 48 after the Zionist regime ordered residents of northern Gaza to evacuate their homes in October. Muhammad insisted on staying put. Muhammad, also known as Abu al-Abd, was a resident of Shajaya neighborhood in the Gaza city. His neighbor and close friend, Muhammad Abu Baid, left Shajaya and went to Rafah, Gaza's southernmost city, following the Zionist regime's evacuation orders. Muhammad Abu Baid did his best to keep in touch with Muhammad al-Salk, although it was very difficult given that internet access has been restricted for most people over the past few months. Muhammad Abu Baid said, I constantly asked him to leave his home and move south, but he would not agree. In December, the Zionist regime forces stormed Muhammad al-Salk's home in Shajaya. He was abducted. When Khulud, his wife, objected to his kidnapping, she was shot and killed. Muhammad al-Salk was killed several days later, according to Muhammad Abu Baid. Al-Salk family was directly affected when the Zionist regime subjected Shajaya to relentless shelling in July 2014. Muhammad's three children were massacred. Because of his injuries then, Muhammad lost his right leg. His neighbor and close friend Muhammad Abu Baid recalled that he always talked about his children and said that he wanted to meet them again soon in heaven. Muhammad Abu Baid also lost one of his legs in 2014. He said, when I lost my leg, I felt that my life was over. Yet the two Muhammads joined forces to set up a football team for amputees. They were also involved in a basketball team for wheelchair users. Muhammad Abu Baid, 37, says of his friend, he filled the place with joy and we laughed a lot. We felt that he would light up everything with his personality. All the amputees felt that he was like a father to us. He said, when one of us got angry during games and exercises, he tried to calm us down. Muhammad al-Salk used to work as a taxi driver. He originally bought his car in installments and provided a taxi service to support his family. After losing his leg, would bring fellow amputees for drives on the seashore. Despite everything Abu al-Abd Muhammad al-Salk lived through, he was a patient and wise man, Abu Bayt said. He added, I will miss him greatly. The Electronic Intifada noted, the Zionist regime's military strategy on the ground certainly points to a deliberate effort at ejecting Gaza's population south to Egypt while rendering Gaza unlivable and return impossible. The Zionist regime's bombardment of Gaza has been among the most destructive and deadly in history, leaving some 70% of homes in the besieged territory damaged or destroyed. The bombardment has destroyed mosques, churches, offices, bakeries, farmland, government buildings, cultural centers, UN facilities, universities and schools. Some 22,000 people have been killed. According to the official death toll, the vast majority, women and children, and just 13 hospitals out of 36 are left partially functioning to attend to more than 55,000 injured people. The military has been pushing 1.9 million people, 85% of Gaza's population, progressively south, first below Wadi Gaza and now as it targets Khan Yunis to Rafah. Having cut food, water, electricity and fuel supplies to Gaza, allowing in only a trickle of aid, 93% of Palestinians in Gaza now face starvation and malnutrition, while soaring rates of infectious diseases are flourishing in the unsanitary conditions of overcrowded, repurposed shelters. Rafah, on the border with Egypt, had a population of 280,000 in October. Now, that number has swelled to 850,000. There is nowhere left to go in Gaza, and while Egypt has been clear it will not allow Palestinians to be removed to its side of the border, it will be impossible for Cairo to resist the pressure if and when people start to die of hunger or disease.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. As Israel's genocidal war on Gaza continues, with full support from the United States, the two allies have not backed down from carrying out acts of terrorism in the West Asia region. Only in recent days, the Israeli regime has assassinated two important figures of the region's resistance front in operations in Syria and Lebanon. And Washington has also shown its disrespect for other nations' sovereignty by conducting a deadly drone strike on the headquarters of Iraq's popular mobilization units in Baghdad. We'll try to bring to the spotlight the ramifications of Washington and Tel Aviv's acts of terrorism in tonight's show. We have Don DeBar, activist and commentator, joining us from Austin, New York. and academic and commentator Daniel Shaw joining us from New York. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. DeBar in Ossining. We're going to kick off this segment with the recent terror attack in Kerman. In your opinion, who benefits from such deplorable acts and from attempts of creating this type of insecurity in the region?
I mean, the thing is done on speculation, okay? There's an expectation that this act will create that effect. The question is, of course, who did it and what did they intend? Pretty clear it was the U.S. or Israel, the intent to create instability in Iran, to provide some sort of domestic satisfaction for people in Israel who are looking at Iran through the propaganda, you know, machinery there as an enemy or the enemy. And so, you know, you can tell who benefits basically, if they benefit, by what happens. Well, you know, several things could happen. Iran shows, in fact, that it's a stable country, which it is, and it, you know, hunkers down and deals with the effects of this and makes a counter move that, you know, is satisfactory to the people in Iran and also a satisfactory lesson, perhaps, of the cost of doing these things to Israel and or the United States. The other is that they're successful and somehow it creates instability in Iran. I doubt that's going to happen, though, because Israel is on a much weaker foundation than Iran. The people of Iran are sitting on land that they've been on, you know, going back to the Persian Empire. And the people of Israel are sitting on land that they've been in since the late 19th century from Europe, and surrounded by enemies that they've created by inserting themselves into the middle of this region. So I don't think the intended effect is going to, you know, express. And I think it's pretty clear who did it and why.
Daniel Shaw, regardless of who was behind this attack, many analysts that we've spoken to here on Press TV see the Israelis as having a role in the terror attacks. And it's not unprecedented, of course, for the Israeli regime. What do you think?
I agree with Mr. DeBar. The same way that U.S. imperialism has used Israel since 1948 as a proxy force to do its dirty work in the area against the Lebanese, against the Syrians, against the Iranians, against the Palestinians, first and foremost, as they carry out a genocide. Likewise, they have used ISIS. Jake Sullivan's infamous quote from 2015, when he said that ISIS were not their the State Department's enemies in Syria. How many times have they, and this is what WikiLeaks and all of those cables, and that's why Julian Assange and others are in exile or in jail, because they were able to shed light on this topic. Because what the U.S. wants to try to do with their war propaganda is wipe their hands clean of what happened about some 60 hours ago in Tehran. There's nothing that can convince us that it wasn't the Mossad and the Central Intelligence Agency, which has an undisclosed budget. It's an unvouchered budget, meaning they don't have to leave any paper trail for all of their dirty work around the years. A budget somewhere in the range of $50 billion per year for the CIA. And this is right up their alley. They strike one day in Beirut. They strike the next day in Tehran. And then they strike in Baghdad. The arrogance of this empire and of Zionism is almost unparalleled in history.
Don DeBar, looking at the recent Israeli attacks in the region, the assassination of the Iranian military advisor, Sayed Razi Mousavi in Syria, Hamas senior official Saleh al-Aruri in Lebanon. Are these Israeli attempts at expanding their onslaught on Gaza into a wider regional conflict and maybe trying to get the United States more directly involved?
The individual actors have, you know, their individual motivations. Netanyahu, first of all, has his own personal motivations, which is basically a single one: stay out of prison. He has to stay in office in order to stay out of prison. He is sitting on top of a coalition where he's really not the leading partner, and he's become a liability even to them over his handling of this entire affair. And then there is the interests of the state of Israel, quote-unquote, whatever elite that actually is in terms of making and expressing policy. There's certainly the geopolitical interests of the United States, which Israel is a proxy for. They refer to it as an aircraft carrier and whatever, a battleship. And behind that, even, you know, the oil companies, basically, that have a large chunk of the stock of the U.S. government. So we're looking at a war over the resources there and over not just the oil and gas and those resources, and not even just the human resources, but also the, you know, the geographic resources. You know, the location itself is an important strategic asset in fighting Russia and China, which is also, you know, part of perhaps their ultimate goal. So looking at how these things are playing out here, clearly you look to what the interests of the U.S. and of Israel as its, you know, local partner are, and how these things fit into it. I think that, again, you consider the fact that there's a war going on, not the war that began, quote-unquote, on October 7th, and not even the war that began with the Nakba in 1948. This is the war that's been going on since imperialism came to that part of the world to try to, and for a long period of time, to have seized the resources or control of the resources there. You're looking at the British changing the form of imperialism in 1948. In the face, though, of Mossadegh coming to power and the Iranian people really taking control of their fate up until the CIA coup in 1953, and then Nasser, first the construction of Egypt and Syria and Iraq, which was coming on, you're going to see a United Arab Republic across the Arab world. Again, another anti-imperialist rise. The war that took all of those things down and then has saw a reversal with the Iranian Revolution in 1979 is ongoing, and this is just another battlefield in that entire, you know, in that larger war.
All right. Mr. Shah, regarding the assassinations, Hezbollah leader Sayed Hassan Nasrallah earlier today said that the blood of the martyrs of the resistance will not go in vain. And he also said that the killing of Saleh al-Aruri will not go unpunished. There were similar comments from Iran regarding the assassination of Razi Mousavi in Syria. Are these actions producing the results that Israel and the U.S. were seeking, or are they, in the words of Hassan Nasrallah, further igniting the resistance front in the region?
First off, it's very clear that Israel is a Western imperialist creation. It's a Frankenstein. But is this Frankenstein slipping out of the control of their very handlers, of the Dr. Frankenstein that called them into existence? It seems that the U.S. does not want the upper summits of the U.S. ruling class. Do they really want a war with Iran? A nation of almost 100 million people, a rich civilization that goes back millennia. They can't handle the economic rise of China. Russia is whipping their behinds in this NATO-U.S. proxy war against Russia with the Ukrainian people trapped in the middle. Do they really want to open up another massive front against the Iranians, against the axis of resistance? But there can be no doubt that there's an Israeli and a U.S. hand behind these terrorist bombings in Tehran. They bomb into Iraq. They bomb into Syria. They bomb the Syrian airports in Aleppo and in Damascus. They bomb the militias, the anti-imperialist militias in Iraq. They bomb at will. So the Israelis and the U.S. are, in a very cavalier way, they're inviting the resistance to strike back. Of course, it's the military-industrial complex that runs the media in this country. And what we saw yesterday at about 2 p.m. was the most synchronized statement from the New York Times and the BBC and the Israeli Times and Haaretz washing their hands clean as if the West had nothing to do with these terrorist bombings. But there's an abundance of proof. We have to read the gray zone, and we have to read Aaron Mate in the geopolitical report and these other outlets who've been tracking ISIS and their handlers from Benghazi in Libya to the ports of Turkey, back Syria, WikiLeaks revealed this Israeli-U.S. ISIS nexus. Now, yesterday when they made that statement, of course, liberals across the U.S. and everyday U.S. people thought, ah, this is surely a Shiite Sunni dynamic. But it's important to ask at the moment of the ultimate Muslim unity, of pan-Arab and Muslim unity in defense of the people of Palestine who are up against the genocide, right, who benefits from this terrorist bombing?
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Don DeBar, the resistance front in Iraq, it continues to put pressure on the U.S. administration with its anti-Israeli and anti-U.S. operations. But Hassan Nasrallah today, earlier, said that following the recent targeting of a leader of the popular mobilization units in Baghdad, Iraqi politicians now have a historic opportunity to expel all U.S. forces from Iraq. Now, let's go rewind to the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani in 2020. Iran also said that one way of avenging his death would be the complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. How close are we to seeing that day?
I forget what the official count is, 2,500, I think, or supposedly. You know, recent events have actually, exposed the fact that the U.S. still occupies Iraq. You know, occupation is a fact, not necessarily, a set of individual situations. For example, if the United States is exercising control at gunpoint of the, the nation state or policy making of Iraq, whether they have a million troops there or two, the occupation is an occupation. The fact that it's still occupied has been, again, exposed by the recent events there and the attacks on the U.S. Military assets by the Iraqi forces and by the Iraqi people. One of the things that gets sort of obfuscated in conversation about these matters is the word terrorism. I mean, we're talking about warfare, okay? Terrorism is a term that came into usage when there were articles or acts of warfare committed by either non-state actors or by the other in terms of propaganda. In fact, and it's even more complicated given the sort of the political, the legal political situation that exists on the ground in that region and in a number of other post-colonial regions. You have contradictions between the, you know, the states themselves that are former colonial states and some semi-colonial states now. And you have contradictions in some cases, like in Saudi Arabia, between the population that's there and the, you know, the government, particularly in terms of relations with the United States and Israel. And so if you look at lose all these, you know, other terms that are the popular ones and think of it in, you know, strategic terms in terms of warfare, you have, you know, the populations in, you know, the population of the nations around Israel, around Palestine, that are all in favor of protecting the Palestinian people and adamant about this. And now look, witnessing, like, you know, the worst genocide, you know, certainly since there have been TV cameras to record it in human history. And their governments debating at the United Nations about it. And finally, one nation submitting a claim at the ICJ. There are a lot of those contradictions that are going to be resolved over the course of this, you know, whatever conflict. And I think in some of the more reactionary states, you're going to see the governments change, including, I don't mean just the individuals in the government, but the nature of the governments in relation to people change. And that is going to happen under conditions of active warfare, you know, in a number of these states and the state and what they call the state of Israel. And so it's difficult to predict what's going to happen. Other than if some way isn't found to put this fire out and to provide justice and safety for the Palestinian people, it's going to be a bloodbath there.
Daniel Shaw, the Yemeni armed forces continue targeting Israeli-linked ships and vessels bound for the occupied territories, despite the formation of the U.S.-led naval coalition in the Red Sea and Washington's threats and warnings. Tell us more about this defiant message that the Yemenis are sending to the U.S. and its allies, as they've been clear these attacks will persist until Israel ends its crimes against Gazans.
All of humanity has a debt with the Yemeni people, with who we call in the West the Houthis, these forces of resistance. I mean, this is a small country of only 30 million people, and to stand up to empire and their Zionist underlings is extremely impressive. And this is on the heels of over 7 years of a horrific U.S. proxy war of using the Saudis to really wage a campaign of starvation, of horrific bombing against the Yemeni people. This was horrific violence that we almost never learned about here in the United States. And now they're doing the same thing to the Palestinian people. The U.S. has almost single-handedly destroyed Iraq, destroyed Syria through a covert, dirty war. They've dismembered and destroyed Libya. And a big part of the foreign policy establishment wants to Iraqize or Libyaize or Syriaize Iran, one of the strongest countries in the region, and the spearhead of this axis of resistance, which counts among its cadre, the Yemenis, the Iraqi militias, Hezbollah. There's no question that Israel wants every excuse, every pretext to continue bombing the daylights out of their neighbors. But as Mr. Dabar has indicated, there's a half a billion Arab people in the Arab world watching on, 8 billion members of humanity watching this horrific Holocaust of the Palestinian people. So when would Israel ever have peace with its neighbors when for 75 years they've treated their neighbors with genocidal violence?
Sure. Don Dabar, in spite of all the efforts to weaken the resistance in the region, why is the resistance front still thriving?
This is what human beings do. We don't die easily, any of us, as a group, as individuals. It's in our nature to try to live. You know, it's the way this thing is taking shape is an unusual, you know, historically unusual methodology being expressed. It's kind of like at an individual, you know, national or regional level, where you would have a guerrilla war as a, you know, revolutionary spear. Only this is the, you know, falling together of those aspects of the various nation states in the area that see the emergency that has to be addressed, and rolling up their sleeves and you know, going to do it. Any one of these individual states declares war on Israel, the United States, and Israel focus their, you know, whatever the power they have, their militaries on that to make an example of them in front of the others. That's their traditional model. Looking to the Vietnamese war, or the American war, as they call it, in Vietnam, the resistance there was not conventional resistance. And this that we're seeing develop here is an unconventional resistance also, kind of that sort of model that you know, may well produce some unexpected results that they hadn't planned on in the Pentagon or in Langley or wherever whatever rat hole they make these plans on in the so-called state of Israel.
Dan, I shall find a question for you as well. Why is the resistance front still thriving in the region in spite of all the efforts to weaken it?
Ho Chi Minh said no amount of modern war technology could defeat a people's will to be independent. This is about sovereignty. This is about indigenous dignity. The U.S. and Israel would have to wipe every last Iranian, every last Arab, every last Alawite, every last Kurd off of the face of the earth. People are going to continue to resist. And how could we ever forget the chief of the Mossad as well, who said publicly that al-Nusra Front, that the worst terrorist outfits operating in the Syrian theater and the Iraqi theater were allies of the Israelis and deserved compassion. And he said this publicly on Al Jazeera. So we have an abundance of proof that the Israelis and the U.S. have indeed kept al-Qaeda and ISIS on a short leash. And this is something that the American public has to look into closely, as well as the Western world.
Mr. Dabar, I saw you nodding there. Would you like to share with us your final thoughts?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think citing Ho Chi Minh, as Dan just did, is exactly appropriate.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Activist and commentator Don Dabar joining us from Austining, New York, and also from New York academic and commentator Daniel Shaw. Gentlemen, thank you for contributing to our program, and also a special thanks to you for staying with us.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran while shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails to our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of YRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Agha Muhammadi. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Okay, Shaykh Agha Muhammadi, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the rewards for shedding tears for the afflictions on the Ahlul Bayt. And is it more praiseworthy than happiness for them? For example, we have different majalis for the Ahlul Bayt. Some of them are commemorating the martyrdom of the Ahlul Bayt. Some of them, for example, about the birthday anniversary of the Ahlul Bayt. So some of them are sad ones, some of them are happy ones. Now, which one is more valuable, shedding tears for Ahlul Bayt or being happy for them?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa alayhi tahirin. What matters as a state of soul is to be remindful of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so we have to see that which state keeps us in better dhikr of Allah and remembrance of Allah. First of all, we have to bear in mind that happiness or sorrow or to be in a kind of grief for Ahlul Bayt or whatever, generally speaking, we cannot say that this one, which one is good or bad. So it depends on the purpose and the reason for these states. If we are we are in the state of happiness for some criminal act we have done, mm-hmm. this is not good.
Okay.
If we are in grief defending an oppressed person, this is great. So happiness and sadness and sorrow, they themselves, they don't matter. What it matters is that what these states are for, what is the cause for these states.
Yes.
And I said the general state is that to be remindful of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to consider some state of soul to be accepted, to be encouraged and admired. Again, another point, general point is that we have hadiths from Ahlul Bayt, from Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, that our lovers, our followers are those who are happy in our happiness and they are in sorrow in our sorrows and hardships.
Yes.
So means that they have sympathy with us.
Uh-huh.
And this makes us to be with them. Imam Amirul Mu'minin alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha in a hadith says that إِنَّمَا يَجْمَعُ النَّاسِ السَّخَةُ وَالرِّزَى. What makes people to be together, what mm-hmm. makes a community, what makes a society is the matters of like and dislikes. Mm-hmm. So if you have the same likes and dislikes with somebody, you are of the same community with them.
Yes.
And then Imam alayhi salam refers to the story of the camel of Saleh alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. And Imam says that one person, one individual killed that camel.
Yes.
But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala punished the whole city and said, فَعَغَرُوهَا. Agaruha means all of them killed, all city killed the camel, while one person killed the camel. Why all person killed the camel? Because they were happy with what he did. And this is the nature of the likes and dislikes. That so when you are in the same likes and dislikes with some people, then it should be shown in your life. So when you're happy with some people, when you like some people, then you are happy in their happiness. You are sad in their sadness. When we love our children, in their success we are happy, in their hardships we are in sorrow. The same is Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam.
That's right.
This is the general speaking.
Mm-hmm.
But beside these things, there is something in the nature of happiness and rapture that differs it from the sorrow and sadness. So sadness, it's a, in the normal understanding, it's a, there is a negative tinge in it.
Yes.
So I'm not necessarily talking about that side of sorrow and pain that we have when we have some hardships in the life.
Mm-hmm.
So when we are crying for Imam Hussein, when you shed tears for Imam Hussein, you know that that nature of sadness and sorrow, the spiritual sadness,
yes.
is different.
It's different, that's right.
Like, you know, in the Western literature, they talk about the tragedy, and they say that tragedy is greater than comedy.
Yes.
You know? So this is in the nature of the state that this is more serious.
Mm-hmm.
And so those who are sort of elites, usually they like the tragedy. They prefer tragedy.
Because there is a kind of catharsis, you know, somehow emitting out the emotions, you know, and then, for example, at the end of this, sadness will be a kind of rapture inside the heart.
This is more mature, you know, this is more mature. The kids, they like maybe comedy.
Comedy, that's right.
But when you are grown, when you are mature, so when you develop your mind, then